Guten Abend. Guten Abend, herzlich willkommen, liebe Gäste, Kolleginnen. Herzlich willkommen, Kirsten Hasstrope, zum siebten, glaube ich. Siebten, kann man mich hören hinten?
Ja,
so, okay. Zum siebten Institutskolloquium, Decentering Europe, Post-Socialist and Post-Block Perspectives for a Reflexive European Ethnology. I will switch, if you don't mind, already into English, so we can stay in the language of the talk and Kirsten can follow us. I'll start by, well, maybe it's a slightly unusual way in, just to make clear what's going to happen tonight. I'll start by, with the name of Konstantin Novoselov, I think his name is, and it probably doesn't ring too many bells. He's a physicist. He's based in Manchester. And in 2007, he wrote an application to the European Research Council for a project, and he got the project, and the acronym for the project, which is always very important if you want to get money in Europe, the acronym is probably the most important thing, the acronym was graphene. And that probably rings a bell, because that was the Nobel Prize for Physics in 2010, so this year. So that's still not particularly relevant to us as European mythologists. It's interesting, but not particularly relevant. It is interesting tonight, though, because Kirsten Hasstrup is leader of a very similar project from the same slot. It's called Water Worlds, and it's funded by the same European Research Council as part of the Advanced Grant Funding Programme. Now, mentioning the kind of the Nobel Prize thing, because this is what the European Union is trying to do. Now, there is no Nobel Prize in anthropology, so that's a shame. I shouldn't be, maybe, but there isn't. But still, I just wanted to kind of give you the frame of what this is. This is sort of the Rolls Royce of European funding, and it goes to very, very prestigious scholars and projects. And Water Worlds, that's the main title, and the acronym, so that's a very good one, obviously. And the subtitle is actually broader than this, so it's not just about water and climate change, as many may think, but the subtitle is Natural Environmental Disasters and Social Resilience in Anthropological Perspective. And we will hear a lot more about this, or a section of this tonight. But I do advise you, because whatever you're going to talk to us tonight, there's so much more to know about this incredibly rich project that has so many sub-projects. So do go to the website, just Google Hasstrup Water World Copenhagen, and you'll be fine. So that's what we're going to be hearing about tonight, and that just gives you the frame of what's going to happen. The fact that Kirsten has been awarded this project also means that if I go through the list of publications and recognition and whatever, I'll be here all night. So I won't do that. I'll just say that she's an anthropologist, just to do the formal part, and professor of anthropology at the Department of Anthropology at Copenhagen University. And she has published very, very widely in Danish, but also in the kind of key English anthropological literature, on issues reaching from environmental anthropology into history, into questions of theory and epistemology, largely and especially lately on Greenland and Icelandic society and issues of the far north, if you like, and social life up north. And I guess it's a very different way into the problem that this colloquium is focused on so far. It's a way in through environmental anthropology, and it's probably coming at this with we were talking about this for a while now, with the issue of scale in terms of, you know, if Europe is about center and periphery and it's about the entanglement of it all, different scales in terms of geographical but also epistemological scales are really at the heart of the Water Worlds project. But this is not about me. So I'm just handing over to Kirsten Hasstrup. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for presenting your work.
Well, thank you very much for the kind invitation to speak here, and for the kind introductory words as well. It is indeed my pleasure to talk here about my project, Water Worlds, but I'm not going to go through all of the sub-projects, nor am I going to focus on my own project in North Greenland. I did talk about that yesterday afternoon in one of the laboratories here, and it was such a pleasure to be able to delve into the pictures and the materiality of the localities of change. But today I'll have a rather more theoretical agenda, which I thought would fit more nicely into the program of this Decentering Europe colloquium. Yes, And I hope you'll bear with me. I don't have any pictures. I'll have to paint my argument in words only. But I hope to keep you awake at least for the better part of an hour, and then we'll discuss what I'm saying. So at the present moment in time, there is a feeling that not only the physical but also the intellectual landscape is changing in the wake of what is known as global warming. The challenges captured in this sweeping diagnosis of a global malaise impinge upon the work of scientists and scholars of all kinds, including, of course, anthropologists and other social scientists working in places where people and communities are hit by the local consequences. And I think time has come to take stock of its theoretical implications for anthropology as well, of course, as for ethnology, usually working on a human scale rather than a planetary one. While I'm not speaking here much about Europe directly, I will do so implicitly, and I'm certainly speaking a lot about decentering. So I hope we can still discuss some of the key issues in your series of lectures here. There are climate skeptics who question the range of the global crisis and especially, of course, the anthropogenic nature of the current trends of change. But most of the enlightened world agrees that the Earth system is facing a major challenge, even if climate as such is also a concept to which a variety of social meanings adhere. There is a sense that humanity itself stands at a threshold. And environmental and climatic issues are some of the most important elements in this identification of a malaise here. Whatever the alleged end cause or the predicted speed of the current changes, there is no doubt that the causal chains are complex and put science to test. Even in anthropology, conventionally studying people in particular places, the new realities of global climate change outstretch all theories about locality, sociality, and connectivity. This is particularly clear in studies of climate-related migration, which challenge conventional understandings of population movements across national boundaries, and thus so far being constrained by the conceptual world of methodological nationalism that has sort of been the foundational method of social science in general. But if we, for a moment, allow ourselves to see the idea of climate change as an imaginative resource, also within the social sciences, we may contribute a renewed understanding of the profound entanglement of the local and the global. And that was actually foreshadowed in Jörg's comments before I started here. And this entanglement runs counter to the insistence on seeing the local and the global not only as distinct, but even as mutually exclusive perspectives. Thus, in a recent paper, it has been argued that the notion of global climate change in itself silences the local, not to speak of the native voices, that would potentially challenge the dominating Western ways of knowing, being, and doing. But my point is sort of rather the opposite. Firstly, because all voices are equally localized and equally capable of talking about something beyond the place from which it speaks. And also the idea of a distinct Western point of view is untenable and even naive these days. Even our viewpoints are very diverse and deeply entangled with viewpoints from all over the globe, and increasingly so. So even if voices are, of course, naturally localized, I shall argue that our scholarly descriptions cannot remain local in the old sense. We know from many recent ethnographies that people all over the globe, including Europe, of course, are already affected by new environmental realities, and that we are under pressure to take action, not only conceptual action, but certainly also practical action. It is still unclear, however, how such action may be shaped if we are not simply to victimize local cultures as if they were simply entities. While documentation of local changes is essential, we should take anthropology as far as it takes to deal with the new global realities. If we take the topography of climate change seriously, We must transcend the understanding of our object of study as an entity which can be neatly packaged within a holistic framework, and we must acknowledge the complexity of scale involved in the ethnography of changing environments as experienced in diverse regions. Here I shall address the need to rethink global connections as well as local communities with a view to present historical realities. I shall relate a case from Greenland in order to ground the argument in the real world, but as I said, my ambition is rather more theoretical here, because I do suggest that anthropology itself finds itself at a watershed conceptually and ethically, and that we need to expand our conceptual framework to meet the challenge posed by global climate change in the wake of all other kinds of globalizing processes. But first I shall try to deal with the global connections and the challenge of entanglement before I get to the Greenlandic case. I take it as axiomatic that the framework of anthropology today is one of globalization. After a full century, that is the 20th century, that saw anthropology establish itself firmly as an empirical science of local communities, in the 21st century, anthropology faces the challenge of truly dealing with globalization as a complex historical and indeed ethnographic fact. While anthropology of the late 20th century did not overlook this fact, as testified to by numerous studies of global flows, transnational migrations, and post-colonial realities in general, it still dealt mainly with the local symptoms of new global flows, whether in the form of information, people, images, or material goods transcending regional boundaries. With global climate change at anybody's doorstep, we are forced to rethink our ambition and deal with the global flows in a more comprehensive theoretical mode. Climate change is certainly not external to people's lives, yet it transcends the local. It means that well-established concepts of locality and responsibility no longer cover the perceived realities. I think we have indeed reached the era, at the end of an era of methodological nationalism in the social sciences. Cultures or societies cannot be taken for granted as a relevant starting point for the analysis. Rather, the reality and the identity of whatever world we describe and discuss must be shown in the course of the argument. Certainly, climate change does not respect neither national nor cultural boundaries, and the distinctive modern view of the nation-state of the European kind and the accompanying political responsibilities is increasingly undermined, and not only for reasons of weather and wind, of course. As noted recently by a scholar of the Arctic, and I quote her, "For most people in Arctic nations, the phenomenon of climate change is now a piece of their life worlds because it has entered the space of communicative action, the social space where people engage ideas and have a meaningful debate." The bow here to Habermas is well taken because it reminds us that even though in many ways beyond the immediate horizon of international politics, people out there are by no means ignorant of the larger climate threat. It has entered into their communicative space. Climate, as such, need not be part of direct experience because, as we know, it takes a comprehensive and relatively long-term perspective to establish a pattern sufficiently stable to speak of climate. And what is happening now across the globe is precisely a destabilization of a climatic regime that has been more or less steady for centuries, and this is experienced as increasingly unpredictable weather in all the regions that we work. The distinction, which is a conceptual distinction that has been hailed in anthropology and elsewhere, between climate patterns and weather events is not always so neat, of course. Because of both its global scale and its high international interest, climate has actually entered into local and more immediate concerns than previously. One could say that climate change, I mean, in this comprehensive sense, has descended into the experienced weather worlds, to borrow a term from Tim Ingold, for whom the weather world is a world of wind and weather, within people attend to their world and, one may now add, within which they engage in communicative action. Rather, many anthropological studies from all over the world now show the unpredictability of local weather worlds, and also show that it is increasingly explained locally by reference to global climate conditions. Even such an event as the tsunami of 2004 is now being sort of explained, sort of backtracking by reference to climate change, although it had nothing to do with it, of course. But other factors like coastal erosions, of course, do account for the massiveness of the onslaught of the tsunami on these coastal areas that it hit. But we can see from all our 15 projects across the globe that climate change has indeed entered into the space of explaining what is happening. And I think that this implied short-circuiting of weather and climate is one inducement to rethink global connection in anthropology. With a view to another and not totally unrelated environmental issue, Anna Tsing has recently suggested a new ethnographic take on global connection in her book Friction, An Ethnography of Global Connection. I'm sure some of you know it. Tsing studied the fate of the Indonesian rainforest, increasingly threatened by capitalist enterprise and deforestation, but also vigorously defended by a wide range of local and international environmentalists, with each their vocabulary. The book, I think, is an important contribution to an understanding of the actualities of local environmental vulnerability in the wake of global capitalism and its uneven infiltration of local systems. And about an ethnography of global connection, Tsing writes, and I quote her here, "How does one do an ethnography of global connection? Because ethnography was originally designed for small communities, this question has puzzled social scientists for some time. My answer has been to focus on zones of awkward engagement, where words may mean something different across a divide, even as people agree to speak. These zones of cultural friction are transient. They arise out of encounters and interactions. They reappear in new places with changing events." I greatly appreciate this book and its sort of very sort of untraditional composition, but I would want to take the general ambition a bit further where climate is concerned, because friction, interaction, and encounters all point to meetings, clashes, and exchanges, often on the border of language, and they all presuppose a kind of distinctiveness to cultures, discourses, and life worlds that is no longer tenable for the very reasons that make an ethnography of global connection expedient. These entities have become as transient as the zones of friction themselves. Indeed, they are nothing but. Turning back now to global warming, it is certainly clear that factual statements about globalization in terms of encounters cannot account for the interpenetration of phenomena that belong to different scales. When we are dealing with the perceived threat of global climate change, its uneven nature and its uneven impingement upon local cultures is no less marked than Tsing's well-taken suggestion with respect to global capitalism. The global climate change itself introduces new disjunctions and inequities between local worlds, while so-called traditional knowledge about the environment becomes destabilized. So there is a sense that the global sort of simultaneously envelops the local, all while becoming part of it. Global terrors, whether climatic or political, thus descend into the ordinary, to paraphrase Veena Das on violence, but they do so in uneven ways, according to the region and the degree of vulnerability and poverty and whatever already present in the region. So we need new ethnographies to show how such imbalances occur and how people become literally unsettled as nature develops out of bounds. Beyond ethnography, but also because of it, the major challenge to anthropology now is to devise conceptual means by which to grasp the truly global connections. I would suggest that the relationship between the perceived global threats and the ordinary to everyday life in local communities, because such, of course, still exist, because people live lives in particular places. That's not what I'm trying to sort of dismantle here. It's not so much we need not so much new concepts of interaction as we need perhaps a refined concept of entanglement. This notion has an interesting ancestry. Thus, in The Origin of Species, Darwin wrote, and I quote him here, in that's 1859, "It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank, clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into few forms or into one, and that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved." So apart from the poetic power of this phrase, I think Darwin sort of points to a potential of the notion of entanglement here, comprising a variety of mutually defining life forms as well as larger laws of life and evolution sort of within the same concept. The notion of entanglement, at least in his phrasing here, lingers between the descriptive and the analytical. It both points to a visible mesh of phenomena and to a way of qualifying it and explaining it within a larger totality. The analytical use of the term predominates in the quantum mechanical notion of entanglement, which I've also looked up, of course, and I cannot claim to completely understand it in the context of physics, but I have found it helpful for my own purposes to reflect further on a situation where the states of two or more objects or molecules or whatever it is that they're dealing with are linked together in a way that makes it impossible to adequately describe the one without full recognition of the other, even though the objects may be spatially separated by quite a distance. With respect to climate change, I would argue that the impact of global forces on local experiences result in their de facto inseparability and non-locality. So even though people obviously continue to live and act in particular places, it becomes urgent to develop new modes of understanding the human and social implications of comprehensive entanglements. This notion does not preclude fieldwork, of course. It rather adds to both its necessity and its theoretical potential, because now we have to think, to theorize beyond this sort of wall-to-wall cultural entity that we used to depict. And it's interesting here to recall Clifford Geertz's description of fieldwork in his book After the Fact from 1995, in which he says, "It is not history one is faced with, nor biography, but a confusion of histories, a swarm of biographies. There is order in it of some sort, but it's the order of the squall of a street market, nothing metrical." Today, the confusion of histories and biographies outstretch the local and imply an entanglement also of the natural, social and political and other phenomena belonging to different places and usually to different genres and registers, yet inseparable in practice. This definitively suspends our notions of our received notions of local communities. I mean, people are still living locally, but local communities must be rethought. And I contend that this is one of the major challenges for present-day anthropology, to come to terms with entangled realities defying conventional understandings of holism and of causation while still recognizing the emplacement of people within particular regions. Elsewhere and previously, I've analyzed the long-term development of Icelandic society and noted the profound intertwinement between the natural and social histories from the warm Middle Ages, where the Norsemen settled on this North Atlantic island, and the later cold centuries of the Little Ice Age. During the 15th to 18th centuries, Iceland and the Icelandic society declined to a point of severe demographic, economic, and social crises of all sorts of kinds. With hindsight, one can see how the lack of proper knowledge about the larger processes of the changes that were impinging upon them made the Icelanders respond to the deteriorating climate and landscape in unproductive ways, making them stick to old ways of thinking about themselves as predominantly farmers rather than in reinventing their society to fit the new realities. And there are many lessons in this work that I can't go into here, but I think that my work, although I didn't use that term then, showed that the entanglement of phenomena deriving from different domains, climatic, political, commercial, and social, and belonging to different regional scales, local, colonial, global, and planetary, all sort of fused into this particular and rather sort of melancholy history that the Icelanders went through for about 400 years of poverty and misery, really. But here I shall give you the case of which is of the more immediate concerns of an Arctic people among whom I now work. And that will lead towards a more general discussion of the conceptual challenges that we face in disciplines like ours. So now the Arctic case and the immediacy of climate threats. I think that in the Arctic, the lesson of entanglement, in the sense that I'm trying to develop here, and mutual causation within a larger frame is no less important than it was for Iceland. The theoretical task, again, is one of connecting what appears separate in space and different in scale. The first challenge implies the identification of the interdependence of geographically separate localities, while the second urges us to seek out the common global denominators of climate change in its local realizations. And I would just, as a parenthesis, say here that these common denominators allude to Darwin's notion of these larger laws that seem to govern the endless circulation of the globe. And that sort of implicitly connect all these multiple species on the bank and all the multiple communities of the planet, whatever you are talking about. Now, the melting ice in the Arctic has become an icon of global climate change. For people living there, of course, climate change is but one of the predilections that they have to cope with. And it's vital to keep in mind that environmental conditions always induced people to move about in the Arctic, both seasonally and more permanently. Mobility and flexibility of social organization was a key issue in survival in these very, very harsh surroundings. And already Morse, who wrote about the seasonal morphology of Eskimo society in 1906, saw that the seasonal changes indeed gave rise to what looked like two completely different kinds of community. And in more recent studies, that is, over the past 10 years, it has been ascertained that climate variability, spatial mobility, and social flexibility are the key parameters in any notion of social resilience that we might entertain in the Arctic. The people I study or work with in these years are hunters, one of the few sort of Arctic hunting communities that are still sort of living from the traditional mode of sort of hunting marine mammals and harpooning whales and traveling on dog sledge, etc., etc. So it's in many ways a very traditional community, but it's also, of course, very modern. I mean, people are modern, they're modern in the outlook. But anyway, their mode of living has led me towards the notion of a nomadic landscape, as suggested by Deleuze and Guattari, who defines it in contradistinction to the sedentary landscape, which, by the way, has sort of formed the basis also of the national the methodological nationalism that I talked about briefly before. In the oft-cited essay on nomadology, they claim that, and I quote them here, even though the nomadic trajectory may follow trails or customary routes, it does not fulfill the function of the sedentary road, which is to parcel out a closed space to people, assigning each person a share and regulating the communication between the shares. The nomadic trajectory does the opposite. It distributes people or animals in an open space, one that is indefinite. And remembering also that space is an emerging property of social relationship, as Corsin Jimenez has recently argued, we can see how society takes on a particular texture when based on nomadic trajectories. Sociality becomes subsumed under a larger topographic vision of the world, and the idea of locality is basically unbounded. There is a larger lesson in that that I shall return to later. But sticking to the Arctic, we can see how the emplacement of the Arctic hunters in a particular physical space is closely related to the perception of self and society, and survival has always been dependent on the ability to follow the resources wherever they were. The present environmental challenges are already affecting self-perceptions deeply, given that people all over the world are part of the same communicative space within which climate change features prominently. Locally, the melting ice is no longer simply attributed to weather variability, but increasingly to climate change. And of course, that makes the future much more uncertain than it used to be. I mean, you can live with weather events and variability once you believe that it's only temporary. But there comes a moment when your sense of community shatters due to the increasing unpredictability of everything. But also on a more practical level, the changing weather conditions greatly affect the hunting because movement has become constricted. The early breakup of the ice seriously hampers communication between the settlements within the district and endangers travel, which takes place on dog sledge and these sort of sea ice. There are other reasons than weather variability for the constricted mobility, such like the need to live in sort of larger settlements where you can have a school and a small clinic and what have you. And even though it's a very tiny population, I mean, they do have these sort of modern facilities in the main settlement, numbering about 500 to 600 people. There's a great flux in and out of the settlement, so it's very difficult to count them. My focus here is on the multitude of social implications of environmental change. And one thing is that the whole orientation system by which people have known their place in the world is breaking down. This goes to say that forecasting techniques that are no longer reliable and which therefore add to the risk of travelling by land, sea and ice need to be addressed. The well-known weather variability has developed out of bounds. And I myself have had ample opportunities to experience and discuss this with people living there over the past 4 years. The changes in the ice scape have another major implication for local orientation, as here suggested by a hunter from Kanak, the main settlement. And I quote him here in English, so I've translated it, of course. Glaciers are very notably receding, and the place names are no longer consistent with the appearance of the land. For example, Sermiyasuswak, which means the smaller large glacier, which previously stretched out into the sea, no longer exists at all. That's just one example. And it's actually a very important observation, pointing to a deep-seated sense of change in the local sense of emplacement. Because, and which you may not know it, but place names in the Arctic mostly refer to the physical features of the landscape, to particular hunting grounds, or to activities of some kind, thus testifying to what Keith Basso has called people's participation in the landscape. So place names have for a long time served as a means to crystallize memory and society in an Arctic environment of infinite extension. I mean, they could go wherever they wanted for as long as they cared to travel on the dog sledge. We're talking here about North Greenland. They have about 2,000 kilometers to the next town down south. So, I mean, there's a lot of space around them, and they have traveled by landmarks and by known place names. And for the Inuit outside of Greenland, and that is in Canada, of course, it has also been noted how place names testify to a particular environmental knowledge that are increasingly now historical markers of past possibilities and activities rather than present ones. But apart from this referential disruption of the content of the place names, for the North Greenlanders, the destabilization of the sea ice primarily undermines their basic means of subsistence, namely the hunting of seal from the ice. When the sea freezes over later and break up earlier than before, and when it seems far less stable in between, the hunt is diminished. Also, some of the traditional hunting grounds, notably for walrus, can no longer be reached on sledge because the ice edge has moved somewhere else and the ice is increasingly thin. What is more, the tinier settlements in the district, which number about between 14 and 50 people, and there are three of them left now, outside of the central village cannot be reached because communication between these settlements always took place on dog sledge, of course, and now it's severed for months. And depopulation is a likely outcome. In fact, the process is already in full swing. So in general, I would argue that the experience of a shrinking space for maneuvering increasingly undermines people's experience, people's sense of who they are. Just like histories are intertwined, so are human lives here and now. Because people live whole lives comprising a meshwork of natural, social, practical, experiential, and narrative phenomena that cannot be controlled piecemeal. So it's not simply trying to control the ice, it's everything in one pot, where social life is concerned. And I'm not advocating here politics of cultural survival or conservation, but I am saying that people are affected by forces deriving far beyond the immediate horizon in an all-pervasive manner. However small and remote some of the Arctic communities are, they are also tightly linked to the national, in this case Greenlandic and Danish, and the international political order, and of course to the global economy. So political interests, trade barriers and conservation efforts affect and constrain the capacity for action in the North Greenlandic communities. It has recently been suggested, that's for Canadian Arctic, that a new environmentality, that is the way human subjects understand themselves in relation to the environment, will change with new technologies of governance. And this is extremely significant in the Arctic, where people have generally lived, and literally lived, on the margins of the state. The hunters with whom I work have subsisted on their own account since times immemorial, all while they have increasingly become inscribed in the modern political order. Presently, the current topographical reshaping of Greenland as the interior ice, the ice cap, also sort of shrinks, and the glaciers sort of melt down in a much more rapid pace than before. It coincides with the emergence of a new Greenlandic nation that in itself redefines people's relationship to place and to their natural and social environment. So politics, of course, is very much part of the current changes in Greenland. One of the most pervasive trends in the general political development in the 20th century in general is centralization of the population. Globally, we note that now 50% of the population live in cities, not to say megacities. So the planet has become urbanized, in a sense. And much more of the land is taking up by... It's far less wilderness than before, of course. So that's a demographic trend that is notable all over the globe. And in Greenland, concentration is also marked as if in very modest numbers. I mean, certainly in North Greenland, I mean, the numbers are very modest, but it has meant an increase, first an increase in the population of Kranach, the main settlement, now inhabited by some 500 to 600 people, while another 100 to 120 live in the three remaining settlements in the district. And centralization in some ways is further intensifying these years because of the sort of the severing of the ties of connection between the central and the lesser settlements in this huge district. But it takes this district further than that because the municipality of Kranach has already been amalgamated into a larger northwestern Greenlandic municipality with Ilulissat as its center, some 2,000 kilometers to the south. So this is where people will have to go soon in case of emergencies and to meet the tax officer if they should so wish. They generally don't. But just to take some examples. So they no longer, the administration is moving south. There's no longer permanent doctor at the hospital, etc. So there is, says they feel that they're sort of been squeezed that and sort of are increasingly opting to go south, of course, also for education, etc., etc. So in general, it seems clear that the uncertainties related to the future of the community are magnified because they are underwritten by the signature of the state. This notion is proposed by Vina Das again, who also identified the general paradox of the illegibility of the state. Because in one sense, the state apparently works by way of decrees, laws, and rational calculations on the basis of intentionality and a sense of direction. It works, allegedly, on behalf of the common good. And this, of course, has been the explicit rationale also of the centralization efforts in Greenland, where many of the smaller settlements along the coast are sort of becoming fused into larger ones, at least by design, if not yet in practice. But with each regulation, however, the hunters whom I've talked to about this, they have become more and more integrated into the state, colonial or otherwise, while at the same time they've become marginalized from their own history, always centering on a degree of mobility and flexibility that fitted with their own hunting mode of living. And this is what can never be read from all of these decrees. So whenever the state sets something new in motion, there is this sense, it's rumored, that maybe it has something to do with an implicit wish to resettle us immediately or next year or in 10 years' time or etc. So for reasons of illegibility, I mean, rumors of the state tend to spread and flourish, and they are, and this, it is as if this these illegible aspects of the distant, if ever present state overdetermines the interpretation that feed into their worst fears expressed to me by an inhabitant in the village, that in 10 years we are no longer here. So evidently, centralization and climate change together have deeply affected the people who used to survive by way of mobility. In general terms, it has made them dependent on a smaller range of resources. And therefore, of course, they monitor the environment very closely. And they're concerned with the manifest changes in weather conditions and the new patterns of the breakup of the ice and the increasing difficulties in going on dog sledge for seal hunting through the better part of the year, etc. And as I said, while communication within the district has become difficult for the same reasons. So one could argue that we are facing here what we could call a convergent crisis, meaning that lots of dimensions entering into the sense of crisis in northern Greenland. And it seems that the network of the nomadic landscape now has all too few knots, at least locally, as compared to the network remembered and narrated and as needed to keep up a sustainable social community in the far north. So the nomadic landscape is shrinking, and increasingly the national space sort of takes over and define the relevant nodes that used to be sort of the relevant hunting grounds, etc., etc. And with a convergent crisis as the one these people are now facing, it is no longer a matter, a local matter, of perceiving, knowing, and moving. The new unpredictability of the ice has limited hunting and communication. But people are furthermore, I mean, they're also affected by new global quota system impinging on their access to traditional prey, being always and so far regulated by local rules of protection of which they are very proud. And they never kill more animals than they need, basically. So we have an instance of a local living tradition of protection clashing with a new scientifically based universal quota system. So the resilience so highly praised by some authors dealing with the Arctic is being undermined, and not only, of course, by the melting ice, but by all of these sort of global issues and decrees that infiltrate their life. So the general point is that the current realities that these people are facing force us as anthropologists or scholars of various kinds not only to rethink the nature of the now perforated environments of small communities, but more importantly, they compel us to rethink the notion of resilience itself, given its traditional status as a system's property. What on earth is the system whose capacity for absorption of change that we may measure these days? There are no boundaries in climate change, only connections, entanglements, and environmental perforations. There is possibly no such thing as resilience in the social domain, but in the form of agency, creativity, and responsibility in the face of new global connections. Yeah. There is still a local problem, however, of course, in that skills, I mean, that is local skills and knowledge have become partially separated, and this is not only an Arctic predicament. We also know that in Europe, the basic skills by which we control the environment until recently are becoming increasingly irrelevant in view of the new challenges that we are facing. Yes, so now for the more general points here that I call transcendent fear and a global social imaginary ? The general point that I wanted to make by way of this case story is that we are facing a major challenge of conceptualizing global connections that keep both the global and the local within the same picture. I mentioned the notion of entanglement, but I'm taking it in a slightly different direction here. And I think that global warming propels us in that direction in an accelerating tempo. For all its obvious globality, climate change certainly hits locally. The consequences are experienced on the ground by people leading ordinary lives as best they can. For them, and they of course now include ourselves increasingly in Europe also, a new sense of uncertainty has crept into the ordinary. Sigmund Bauman has spoken of a liquid fear saturating the everyday life of people worldwide and seeping into their perception. He was not predominantly talking about climate change, not at all actually, in this first book. But anyway, I take his notion a bit further here, because he also suggests that fear differs from risk in that the former relates to something unknown and even unknowable, while risk is identified with reference to something known. It is possible to act upon... To act upon perceived risk, but not upon unbounded fear, because you don't know where to address it. The question which Bauman does not address then becomes how people or societies may still find ways of creating spaces of certainty, allowing them to act responsibly, irrespective of all these nanotechnologies of fear infiltrating everyday life and undermining a sense of a reasonably steady horizon of expectation. He's dealing mainly with the political terror, but I'm sort of taking, sort of borrowing his notion for what I'm talking about here. It seems that any new space of certainty has to be much more comprehensive than the local, social, and even national space. And my implicit point here is that people can only act responsibly within sort of some space, some horizon of expectation. They need to be able to anticipate at least some of the developments that are going to take place within the perceived drama in which they are participating. So responsive action depends on at least a degree of anticipation, and we cannot expect people to deal with that in their small circumscribed communities already infiltrated by global vocabularies. So what I suggest here is that what we are facing today is not simply a new set of connections and new uncertainties, but possibly and positively also an emerging global imaginary to expand the notion of the social imaginary suggested by Charles Taylor. His main concern, and his sort of developing his notion of the social imaginary from the modern development in Europe, and his concern is that this social imaginary has grown out of the Enlightenment and having until this day set the moral framework of society in Europe and elsewhere. Importantly, Taylor is not positing the imaginary in contrast to the institutional. Rather, he suggests that it is a term for what enables through making sense of the practices of a society. This imaginary of which he speaks is underpinned by a particular moral order, which in the modern period became closely associated with ideas of natural law and with the political entity of the nation state and the social contract it entailed. Over the past centuries, and certainly in colonial times, the modern social imaginary expanded to places beyond the Western core and to domains beyond natural law and state politics. And there was a sense in which this sort of basically European concept was being exported to all the globe in the wake of colonialism. And I would want to argue here that partly owed to the unification of the globe through climate change, we are maybe on the verge of a new global imaginary. The political entity of the state and the social contract between the state and its citizens and between the citizens themselves need revision. The moral horizon must expand beyond the national boundaries because people's imaginations are deeply infiltrated by global connections and images, and new normative notions and expectations are emerging as a consequence, if still dimly perceived. The world has opened up and the speed of communication has accelerating, incorporating all people in the know and making climate part of the communicative space. The hunters in the Thule district know as much about climate change as anybody, and not only from their experience of melting ice, but also from the international scientific attention to the region and, of course, from the web. They still do not know how to live with it, of course, and have to navigate their terrain on an extremely short-term basis, although, of course, new dreams are taking shape. In this, they are like people elsewhere, facing unsettling environmental events. So risk may have been democratized, potentially affecting everybody in equal measure, but vulnerabilities are still very unevenly distributed. And you know that also from Ulrich Beck's work on risk, and I know that he's talking here next week. But in many ways, age-old certainties and patterns of resilience are melting away as well, thereby effectively blocking out people's vision of an entirely local future and shrinking the space of certainty within which they may act. Yet, a new global imaginary and an extension of the horizon may extend this space of certainty, which is also very much a space for taking joint responsibility for the future. people are not equally hit by the current trends of global warming. And it has been suggested that climate change constitutes a perfect moral storm, implying the convergence of a number of factors that threaten our ability to behave ethically. The modern and largely national moral order is inadequate for dealing with the implications of climate change, including the dispersal of cause and effect in both time and space, the increasingly skewed vulnerability and new migration patterns. Climate refugees are already emerging, and we face many new very, very large migrations across vast scale, regional scales here. But also there is a new issue of an intergenerational responsibility that distributes subjects and objects of actions in time. So, I mean, what we do now affects the next generations endlessly. And all of this converges in our current theoretical ineptitude at dealing with global climate change in the socio-political realm. For anthropology, as for the social sciences in general, the theoretical challenge is to tease out a new sense of causality in the human and social domain that may embrace several scales at once. From ethnographies of climate change, we know that causes and effects are entangled far beyond the modern horizon and the modern linear thinking and narration. The modern myth, that's the Enlightenment myth of unidirectional progress, maturation, and even civilization, has come to an end, as has the dominant narrative of the nation and its sovereign people. So we are way past the metrical also in this respect. This, once again, is where the modern social imaginary, as understood by Charles Taylor, falls short of the emergent reality. So we are at the end of an era where the European lead in the international development by the way of its central concepts and fixed values of national sovereignty are being replaced by a yet unfinished world, even on home ground. And now to my concluding remarks here. My general proposition here has been that the well-established field of ethnology, the well-established fields of ethnology and anthropology, stand at a watershed where new global connections challenge the constitutive holistic object. The multitude of perspectives and the perforation of boundaries, political, conceptual, and cultural, has disqualified the constitutive nationalism or culturalism of the social sciences. There is a sense in which the entire global landscape has become nomadic. The boundaries no longer hold its nodes in a point of a vast network where control sort of shifts. As always, the sciences have to move along with history itself, defining and redefining its concepts as realities shift and transcending the empirical instances by identifying their unknown connections. Global climate change, I would argue, constitutes a major empirical shift in the world, or at least in thinking about the world. It impinges upon a global moral order that has been emerging since, I would argue, perhaps since the period of decolonization. Now it's just taking, if we're taking that a bit further. Facing a global problem with stark local implications, environmentally, economically, politically, and socially, we may contribute vitally to a new understanding of truly global predicaments by offering theoretical suggestions, not only and not even principally perhaps, about how global warming affects local communities differently and threatening their ancient life worlds, but about how actions, even at the smallest scale, influence the flows on the macroscopic surface, and vice versa, of course. Our allegiance must be global and reflect what Hilary Putnam has called a pragmatic enlightenment. And like the previous enlightenment, It combines a revolution in knowledge as well as in ethics. His notion of enlightenment sort of covers these two aspects equally. For Putnam, the new ethics is without ontology. So it's not a matter of principles, but of practical concerns. And this, I argue, will take the implicit cosmopolitanism of our disciplines into a new era also, framed not only by moving subjects, continued dialogue and respect, but also by a deeper theoretical understanding of the planetary entanglements of peoples, places and politics. Thank you very much.